This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 431 of the world's greatest writing podcast. How's everybody doing? Getting any writing done? Holding on to sanity? Well, on today's show, Vanessa Blakesley, my sometimes co-host, returns to talk about writing and sex. So we might call this The Drunken Odyssey After Hours Number 1. So I'm going to try and wrap up this intro before I run out and get last-minute supplies. I think that means Fig Newtons and rum before Hurricane Isaias reaches Florida's shores. Now, will it still be a hurricane by the time it gets here? And will it actually get here? Or will it actually grow more powerful and clobber us right in the middle? This is the sort of gambling we do in Florida. So I realized that names are a way that we can keep track of tropical storms so we don't end up trying to refer to the dangerous weather of hurricane season the way gangsters refer to things. Oh, did you hear about that thing? You mean the Brooklyn thing? No, the other thing. Oh yeah, I heard about that. There could be a lot of storms over a season, so we name them, but that kind of makes it eventually feel personal when hurricanes actually do hit us. Isaias means, God is my salvation. What does it mean for a hurricane to be named? God is my salvation. Couldn't we have named this one Ichabod? Which means, and this does bear some meaning for the Washington Irving tale, no glory, inglorious, or where is the glory? Yeah, I think Hurricane Ichabod would have been better. So if you like what you hear today, please do spread the word on social media. And if you have feedback for me, the email is thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. All right, let's talk about sex.
And now, the interview of the day.
I am talking with my dear friend Vanessa Blakesley again, and today we're finally going to talk about sex. I think we've been putting this on hold for a really long time.
I guess so. It has some tension developed.
Well, you know, it was sex that brought us together. In particular, a certain essay you wrote for the Paris Review called The Fetish, which you were kind enough to read on this show in one of its earliest episodes.
That's right. That's right. So there's a nice, here we are coming full circle to a place that perhaps we had, you know, taken our sweet time to get to, but couldn't have been put off forever.
And in some ways, we are kind of office spouses when we're on this show. Anyway, in that essay, right, you were musing upon Marguerite Duras's scandalous memoir / novella, The Lover, which had recently, at least at the time that you were obsessing over the book, probably in the 90s. And I remember when that movie came out. And let me say, it kept my attention.
Right. Yeah, that it was because of the film. And I think, you know, somehow, gosh, I'm trying to think of how we would have seen the movie if it came to like the art house cinema near our VHS town tape. Or I don't.
That's what you said in the essay.
Yeah, I guess somehow we got our hands on a tape of that. And then that led me to it is a good film, and it led me to the book. And then I went on a spree, I think, of, you know, unearthing all these erotic literary classics like Lady Chatterley's Lover, The Story of O.
All of the epic smut.
You know, these epics. And to varying degrees of being, you know, I don't know, I think sometimes I was really disappointed by them, or they weren't what I imagined, or I don't quite know. And also I had nothing really to compare them to since I was... completely inexperienced 16-year-old. So there's that. But I guess you're trying to get information at that stage of your life.
And the information was mysterious in The Lover, right? It tells the story of this 15-year-old French girl in what was then called Indochina and her relationship with a Chinaman. And that's her phrase, not my phrase, by the way, dear listeners.
Yeah.
Marguerite Duras, do not get me in trouble. And one of the claims she makes in that book is that, like, on an intuitive level, she knew sex, she knew desire, and she kind of had nearly all of the answers, which is why when she gets this offer of a ride home in this man's limousine, she takes him up on it, and then this kind of bizarre, torrid, pedophilic affair begins with this guy in his 20s, and she is 15, which I think the book... and the movie present as both scandalous and understandable.
Yeah, that I think so. And it's sort of a reverse Lolita story, I guess, and where the Lolita is speaking, and she's a little bit older. You know, she is 15, 16 as she carries on this affair while she's at boarding school or something like that. So she's, you know, at an interesting point. But I think what I remember about the book was that it also went more into her family's, into class, the class of the French colonial people who were there and her family's, I guess, poverty, actually. They weren't well off, and how that played into her decisions in the story.
Well, they were middle class, but failing and collapsing.
Failing, yeah.
So that if they were actually just lower class, they would have probably felt a lot more secure and okay in the world. But instead, you know, the world, their little colonialist spot in the world was crumbling.
Crumbling, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which it makes it really, I think a lot more interesting, adds a lot more depth to the, you know, character situation as she's talking about it, because there's sort of her going to this boarding school, and I think maybe she only sees her parents on her family on the weekend or something like that, is sort of their last, still trying to cling to the last, you know, the last crumbs on the last spokes on the ladder, however we want to say it. And the fact that this, you know, wealthy foreign man, he is foreign to her, sort of, she can enjoy the, you know, experience, and that's all part of it, I think.
But one of the unnerving aspects of it is how she just seemed fully prepared for these sexual experiences. And ultimately, maybe what she was unprepared for was the romantic attachment that she was unaware that she was forming. But you read the book, caught up in its literary spell, figuring it would give you, you know, the psychic knowledge of sex.
Yeah, it didn't. It didn't at all.
And then you go to Paris and the opportunity presents itself and you're like, okay, this doesn't feel French in a literary way. This is.
No, I could not have been further away from where that character was in her awareness and development. And just, I mean, really, truly, oh my goodness. I mean, it's laughable to me now, knowing myself, you know, at midlife so much better, but you know, whatever, it's all part of the journey. She's a very good writer. So I'm glad I discovered an author who I would have not been aware of. And I really should read a few more other works by her than just The Lover, which I have not done.
Well, that essay was called The Fetish. And so I'll link both to that episode of The Drunken Odyssey in its infancy and also to the Paris Review printed version for those people who prefer to look at it with their eyeballs instead of their earballs.
Well, thank you. And I assure people that the essay version is much more, you know, entertaining than me trying to summarize it or give it any, like, just read the essay. It's much, it's much better than me talking about it.
So we've isolated two different sources that address the subject of sex in writing. And because they're both short, we are definitely just going to read them before we delve into a further conversation. So the first one is from the Paris Review, and it's kind of a letter exchange answered by the writer Lauren Stein. So do you want to read that?
Yes, absolutely. It's called Why Write About Sex, from the Ask the Paris Review column. It was published June 24th, 2011. And someone writes, Dear Mr. Stein, a few of the pieces in your most recent issue, particularly Mr. Seidel's and Miss Baradale's, strike me as rather vulgar. I'd be interested to hear your opinion on why so many contemporary writers, when dealing with sexual content, veer toward explicitness instead of subtlety. I just don't understand why the crass language is necessary. Delicate hints and suggestions of such acts are usually more titillating anyway. Betty Lou. Another letter. Dear Mr. Stein, a while ago I read Elizabeth Bachner's article, Awkward, Disgusting Copulation, Writing on Sex, and I found that she expressed so accurately what I seek out in literature. Quote, there's something deeply unfortunate about the fact that urination, procreation, defecation, and orgasm all happen within such inconvenient proximity. Having a human body will kill each of us eventually, no matter what, so we might as well enjoy it. But it's not for the squeamish. Western culture, in fact, has largely developed around the tension between revulsion and fascination, between being grossed out and turned on, end quote. I can't find any other explanation for why I can't close my eyes when Vonnegut gets dirty or Nabokov cruel. Do you know of any contemporary writers who write with similar zeal? Sebe Remoltu. And this is Lauren Stein's response. As you both point out, writing about sex can be gross and unpleasant, unsexy even. So why publish that kind of thing in the Paris Review? Betty Lou, your question strikes me as very reasonable. I'd answer first that not all writing about sex is meant to titillate. There are other reasons to describe what people do in bed.
Hear, hear.
Not all of these reasons are vulgar or crass. To my mind, a conventional sex scene, say in an airplane novel, as she raised her hips and guided him into the hot, wet center of her, et cetera, is indeed crass. But is it crass? Is it meretricious to write honestly about the mass and complexity of the individual libido? Not to me. What's vulgar is an airbrush. What's really vulgar is a sex scene in borrowed language, where the characters are stripped of individuality and the situation has no moral depth. I hope we don't publish anything like that. More generally, it strikes me that fiction and poetry are especially good at dealing with sex, are in some ways designed for handling subjects that are private or shameful or deeply subjective, and that sex is inherently interesting, maybe especially to readers of fiction. Of course, it is boring, plus creepy, to hear someone drone on and on about sex in general. What's wonderful is how the particulars keep appearing out of the fog of daily life to seize our attention, like faces we've never seen before and could never have imagined before we saw them. As Samuel Delaney told our interviewer in the current issue, "I shall always be able to come up with new fantasies, as long as there are people walking around in the street, as long as I have books to read and windows to look out of, I'm not going to use them up. Sebe Remolto, take a cue from Betty Lou, read the last four issues of the Paris Review, and while you're at it, Frederick Seidel's poems 1959 to 2009. You may also find yourself troubled in various right wrong ways by Mary Gateskill's Veronica, Dennis Cooper's Guide, Louis Begley's The Man Who Was Late, Eugene Martin's Firework, Richard Sitkin's Crush, and Nicholson Baker's very funny House of Holes, A Book of Raunch. The last doesn't come out till August, but I think you'll agree it's worth the wait." And I will just add that I am not very familiar with any of those authors except Mary Gateskill, having read her book, her short story collection, Bad Behavior, which I have not read Veronica, but Bad Behavior is definitely a book with that depicts sex in literary fiction and does so really, really well. And
yeah, that's the collection that has Secretary in it, right? Which was adapted into...
Yes, yes.
It was a somewhat notorious film.
Yeah. Yeah, different stories about prostitution, call girls back in the 60s and 70s, I think, you know, in New York. And I have read something by Nicholson Baker. I can't remember which. I found it really, difficult, not my aesthetic, where I was just like, all right, like, interesting to check out. I can't remember which title it was, but I do recommend Bad Behavior if you don't want to, you know, just to get a taste of Mary Gateskill.
I can recommend Veronica. Now, I was fortunate enough to be able to interview Mary Gateskill on episode 193 back in 2016.
Nice recall, John.
I got the laptop in front of me. I'm cheating. I don't remember there being that much sexual content in Veronica. And I'm guessing it's probably more along the lines of it's sexually frank rather than presenting, oh, here's a sex scene, beginning, middle, end. But then again, I think my threshold for what is acceptable and interesting or gross and unforgivable is probably not going to be easily shared by a lot of people. In my 20s, I had my film selection recommendation privileges taken away from me by two separate social groups for suggesting movies. And it's like, oh, I forgot she put a vacuum cleaner up his ass. and I'm not even making that up.
It's interesting. Well, it's probably good that we podcast more together than rather be, you know, couch surfing, movie watching, you know, partners that John something tells me my threshold is probably lower.
Or,
you know,
or maybe you would learn things about yourself.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Or you would just learn things about me that you can't unlearn. That could also be the case.
That would be the case, you know, and undoubtedly a little of both.
So I find the choice of language from Mr. Stein there to be a little bit, and Betty Lou, you know, oh, I want subtlety instead of crassness, and to be explicit is to be crass. And I think that there's a lot more to be parsed there in terms of style than simply, oh, you know, if I can actually see what's happening in the scene, then it's crass. Like which is to suggest that sex itself is crass. And you can't really be specific about it without crossing some horrible line of taste. And to some degree, I get it because, you know, like, what are the appropriate terms for the parts of the body? And, like, there's either the clinical or the crass terms. Like, I don't know that it's difficult to come up with enough, like, literary synonyms and metaphors. Humbert might be able to say the stem of my desire or the scepter, you know. I think Nabokov, and partly because, yeah, that's about pedophilia, the fact that Nabokov used up all those terms now makes them all feel kind of tainted.
Well, I mean, I think there is a certain conundrum with diction, right? Because, you, like you said, you've got you've got the clinical terms, you know, vagina, penis, like, you know, the medical language. And then you have this big gulf where there's like, then there's just the slang that is used. And then you have this, if you want to call it the gray zone or the Nabokov zone or whatnot, where you'd get into metaphors or, and then that could be, you know, really laughable too. And I think, again, undoubtedly, we're going to talk about this, about, you know, just cliche that so much of really any of these, all three of these, because there's been so much writing about sex and romance novels and erotica and letters to Penthouse that it becomes part of the challenge, right? As a literary writer, you just kind of want to slap your cheeks and go, ah, like in talking about tackling bringing sex into your fiction, because you're faced with, well, how am I going to approach this? And, you know, both of us have approached it differently in our fiction, which we can talk about later. But maybe would you like to read the other letter that we have, which echoes some of what, you know, the Paris Review editor is saying.
Let's keep talking a little bit. I, you know, in some ways, this is the author of the sort of airplane novel that Mr. Stein's mocking.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a little bit more, I'd like to just develop our conversation a little bit further. So in your novel, Juventude, I don't remember there being a sex scene. There's...
well, okay, go ahead. she loses her virginity.
This is the problem with my memory. Like, part, you know, like the focus is, you know, it's a father-daughter relationship. And so, mm-hmm. I, you know, my memory of the book isn't, oh my God, that was that awesome sex scene, which is like a good way to store it in the memory.
No, that's a good thing.
I do remember there was definitely, you know, kind of an age-appropriate love interest that was pretty serious.
Yeah. Well, I really tried to handle all that as tactfully as I could, because there is definitely a loss of virginity scene. There is a later on, a few months later, a sort of about to be cunnilingus scene, which with a cutaway to at the end, to, you know, end of chapter, like she looks out at the stars or something through her bedroom window. As, you know, her underwear is being removed. You know, I tried to do those things. Oh, and there, I had to chuckle at the second letter that you will be reading, when she refers to scenes of sex after funeral scenes, because I was like, oh my God, I did one of those. And you know, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but there is a sex after a funeral scene. But you know, I kept the description of that really sort of summarized and brief, if I remember. It did, and actually, I had a longer version of that, where some more conversation and revelation about the characters is coming out, and it ended up being cut because I guess it wasn't necessary. And you know, in looking at what needed to go and trimming back the book, I ended up shortening that scene. It just, what, I guess I liked it, but it was one of those things where when push comes to shove and you ask, is this, you know, scene as they're dressing, you know, dressing again and talking and kind of sending jabs to each other, is that really necessary? Well, you know, ended up being shortened.
So when push comes to shove, so, everything sounds dirty when you talk about sex.
Oh my gosh.
You know, I just talked to Jamie about Lake Life, his first novel, and, you know, like there's a sex scene that got largely truncated, partly because the mm-hmm. mechanics of the sex were less important than the emotional ramifications of the sex, which is, I think, why,
right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's difficult to imagine scenarios in which storytelling requires like the full sexual arc of the sexual experience. And there's a part of me that kind of resists that. Like, come on, why does everything have to be in good taste? But there's, you know, like the other problem of, okay, but if it's just bodies pushing and shoving.
Right. And we're just kind of like, okay, ho-hum. Because, and, you know, what ends up being the more, and it's interesting, the word truncated, that's exactly what I ended up having to do to some, you know, certainly that one scene, and then probably the others a bit as I went through and revised, is that what ends up mattering more, or what is, you know, more interesting is, how are these characters approaching sex? Like, who is inhibited? Who is bold? Who is a little bit, you know, I don't know, more raunchy, or who is more, gives mixed signals. I don't know, you know, how the characters' attitudes about it as they enter the scene or kind of go about things end up being more crucial than once they're fine, just, you know, like, you know, just going back and forth. It's, those are the details that I think we end up being more intrigued by, and then how after the deed is done, then, you know, depending on their dynamic, you know, how does that evolve then? Is there shame involved? Is there guilt? Is there, you know, all of these things?
So, well, okay, I'm going to reference a movie, and for a change, it's going to be a South Korean movie called Lies, and kind of like The Lover, it's supercharged in its erotic content, and again, it involves like an older man. I think it's a writer in his 30s, maybe he's even 40, and then there's a schoolgirl. Why is it always a schoolgirl in these?
Because they're in school. Because when you're under 18, you're in school. They should be in school.
So, like, she's a fan of his writing, and like, she wants to be anointed as a super fan or something like that. And the scenes are fairly pornographic. Like, it's not, oh, and here we're going to have a lot of cuts in order to show a lot of body parts and imply a whole lot of activity. It's like, no, this is kind of close to real time. And we're lingering on shots, and, you know, I think like a half, and there are so many sex scenes. And I think it was like 35 minutes in where the cinematography just starts roaming and trying out. Okay, let's pixelate the scene. The cinematographer got so bored filming the fucking that he's just like, let's try everything, because actually just showing the sex is no longer interesting. And yeah, part of the message, part of the narrative of the story is how this dangerous sexual relationship is exhausting. That, you know, they kind of exhausted the possibilities of sex for each other. And there is a relationship there, like an S&M relationship that, it, you know, like, it's bad for them, but no one else, like, it really bonds them in this very specific way that, like, vanilla sex people just... Like, okay, like, it's just, everything else is just a chore. But if they're together too long, then they feel like the full weight of how destructive that is. So, I mean, it's part of the message of the movie, but if being bored and exhausted is part of the message, you have to convey that without boring and exhausting your audience. Because once you're bored and exhausted, it doesn't really matter if there's a good moral attached. It's like, oh, shit. But I thought that was just so funny how the director and the cinematographer is like, okay, yeah, we're not going to back away from the sex scenes, but we are going to just do random shit with a camera because we're kind of bored. And it's not a bad movie. There are certain movies that promise, okay, we're going to be titillating and it's going to be crazy. And normally it's like, okay, it's a little gross, and you don't have much of a story, and the actors are all right, I guess. But, like, there's no reason to feel at the end like you experienced something. Like, with The Lover, at the end, you're like, that was something.
Yes, I definitely remember that from my upteen views of it as a teenager. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have the sense of something culminating and a sort of sense of loss as this relationship has to inevitably come to its end.
So for those of you who are perverts and need the like artsy version, all right, yeah, the film of The Lover and the film of Lies, I think, is not as great as The Lover. So if you watch, like, well, first of all, don't watch them back to back, have a life, but...
That would be a lot, because I remember The Lover being kind of a long film, too. That would be a long haul.
And I think there were also a lot of meaningful scenes that weren't about those two or the sex they were having.
Right.
So.
Well, do you want to read Don't Be Shy, the other letter?
So, yeah. So I was kind of looking around to see if we could pair the Paris Review piece with something that gives us a little bit of a different perspective. And this is almost random. I found a bit that I liked at the time. J.T. Ellison, New York Times bestselling author, J.T. Ellison, who I haven't heard of because I don't read those kind of books usually. Like every 2 years, I'll just pick a book I would never read and go, all right, I'm going to read this. And occasionally I'm pleased, but normally I just feel harmed by the experience. Like I read The Bridges of Madison.
I hadn't heard of her. The Bridges of Madison County. Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was a finger on the pulse of the culture that I don't know that I needed to. I don't know that I needed to do that. Oh, actually, that book came out when I was a teenager. And I think I read it along with that was part of my, because there was such a craze. I'm glad you brought that up. There was such a craze around that book. And then I got my hands on it at Walden Books or whatever and read it. And as a, 16, 17 year old, I was like, this is the sappiest, most flowery shit I have ever read. Like threw it across the bedroom. I was just like, ah. And it wasn't because, it was about an older couple, or it was just the writing was, I was just like, oh my God, having read the gems of literary eroticism with a lover and this, I was just like, oh my God, this is so.
Even at that age, you had high standards for smut, and I applaud the teenage you for that. So let's now observe a moment of silence for Walden Books. Poor Walden Books. Yeah. So, all right. So J.T. Ellison, her piece is called Don't Be Shy, How to Write Effective Sex Scenes. And there are like multiple layers of like subtitles and section breaks. So, okay. Don't Be Shy, How to Write Effective Sex Scenes. Let's talk about sex, baby. Face it, writing an effective sex scene takes talent. But saying don't be shy kind of suggests anyone can write one. Anyway, sorry. I'm getting lost already. There is no more common denominator in life. Sex literally makes the world go round. Okay, J.T. Ellison doesn't know what literally means. Every single person on the planet is the product of a sexual liaison. Yes, that is a fair point. Sex is universal, but it doesn't make the globe rotate on its axis. Okay, most of us pursue coupling with unflagging enthusiasm. I'd like to see data on. Okay, no more editorializing, sorry. In our society, sex is at the same time revered and venerated, feared and glorified, used for power and influence, celebration and procreation. We as writers must tackle the subject, and we do so in wildly diverse ways. On screen, off screen, doors opened and closed, implied and flagrant. So why is writing a sex scene so damn difficult? The theory is we are so close to our characters, and sex is such an intensely personal act that dropping your thoughts, fantasies, experiences onto the page can be either painful or liberating, or both. There's a huge contingent of erotic writers who capitalize on their imaginations for the pleasure of their reading public, and I say more power to them. Romantic suspense has a massive following, both for the intensity of the stories and the disbelief suspending romanticism that finds women in heightened situations with mind-bogglingly handsome men who rescue, reward, and pleasure the oftentimes repressed, depressed, and feminist heroines. Pure romance, well, that speaks for itself. Who among us doesn't want to have the dark stranger ride in on his white horse and sweep us off our feet? I would be willing to try that at least once. But what about the darker side of life? How does sex fit in with my series and thrillers? Sexual tension.
I think it's mysteries and thrillers. How
mysteries.
Does sex fit in
oh, there
with
we
mystery?
Go. Yeah, I also took notes and the ink bled through the page. This is literally what we call a palimpsest, which also means it's just too difficult to actually read. Sexual tension is a brilliant device for both examining internal fortitude and driving the story along. The act of sex in the page is an immediate and unflinching psychological examination of a character. Are they loose, fast, impotent, frigid, a serial monogamist, a one-off slut? happily married and desperate to get back to their spouse and kids? Literary fiction often covers this territory and the minefields therein, utilizing weeks and years to uncover the motivations behind their characters' sexual relationships. But when you're writing a book that takes place in a 24-hour time frame, the character's actions are paramount. It's difficult to examine life's biggest driving force when the world is about to end, and we genre writers find ways to do it. All right, Vanessa, you're in charge of tracking down what the it there means. Okay. Sex and the Mystery is the topic of many a panel discussion. There's no shortage of lust just because things aren't going so well. It's the sex after the funeral phenomenon. We all know that when the going gets tough, the tough go to bed. That really needs to be on a t-shirt. It's the variety of manners in which we handle these scenes that interest me so much. When a writer decides to open the bedroom, ballroom, bathroom, kitchen floor door, a reader can be shocked by the proclivities and neuroses of a protagonist, cheer their prowess, boo their selfishness, notwithstanding the act itself, finding a deeper understanding of a character's motivation is rarely laid so bare. The fragility, humanity, or pure assholeness of a lead can be fully examined if they are naked. For me, writing a series with two characters who are in love and face life-threatening situations on a daily basis, finding a happy medium is difficult at best. I think it strains the credibility of my characters' lives to have them drop trow in the midst of a murder investigation. Just imagine Taylor and Baldwin walking away from a particularly horrific crime scene. You know, babe, there was something about that girl with her throat cut that made me incredibly horny. I don't think so. If anything, the last thing they'd want to do is have sex, even the life-affirming kind that we mere mortals might succumb to. Yet when you have two extremely attractive people who are a couple who banter, flirt, drink, despair, want, and sometimes even act quite inappropriately, and there isn't even an allusion to sex, the reader feels shortchanged. It's like handing the reader the keys to the kingdom and then saying, sorry, the moat is clogged up and we won't be reopening until 6 p.m. tomorrow. No matter what, I refuse to have sex be a gratuitous tool, something just to fill space. I don't have a sex scene in my first book. I do in my second. The reason I waited was twofold. I wanted the readers to know Taylor and Baldwin without the specter of what they do in their bedroom before I jumped into the deep end. They are definitely together. Certainly sexual creatures, but there is a delicious irony to the fact that they aren't hopping in the sack every chance they get. Actually, they suffer from precoitus interruptus, are stymied by events, and don't have another chance because they are professionals doing their jobs. By the second book, the tension has grown, and when it does finally culminate in a physical scene, it's so fitting to the story that if they didn't do it, the reader would be shaking their head and saying, huh, it was the first on-screen sex scene I've ever written, and I had so much fun working that scene that I wonder why I never tried it before. It's a perfect allegory for the story, rough and intimate, and vertical. Nothing can ever be easy for my characters, so why would I give them candles and silk sheets? I'm not saying one way or the other is better. I just do my best to be true to my darlings. Unfortunately, the sexual revolution hasn't entirely conquered fiction. The male protagonists are practically encouraged to plow a swath through their female compatriots. But we women have to be more careful, making sure that the sex is meaningful and preferably within the confines of a relationship or two. If there's a female lead who unabashedly screws her way through a book and isn't labeled, I don't know of her, but I'd like to shake her hand. To that end, there are definitely characters I want to see bed their co-stars. Reacher and Rain? I mean, come on. Lee Child and Barry Eisler both deserve Academy Awards for their ability to evoke a moment. Take a chance. You never know where it might lead you. Okay. That was longer than I thought.
I found myself as you were starting to read that to look up where it had been published, and then I didn't. It's like, oh, it was published on her own website. So it's sort of her own author blog. So I guess we'll forgive her. Her should have proofread it a little bit more before putting it up there. But I think before we start, I know we have our varying opinions on what she said there and how she said it. But there were a couple points that she made, especially out the gate, that I really felt or very, you know, strong points that if you don't write about sex at all in your fiction, especially in a novel, I mean, we're time is passing. Even if it's a novel that's, like she alluded to, set in a 24-hour period or a very short period, you can run into the trouble of, yeah, we all are here as a result of sex. Sex is very much, you know, one of the basic human behaviors, along with eating, sleeping. And if you leave, if you forget to include it somehow, or give a nod to it or something, that can also over time become really implausible for the reader. And I had completely forgotten about this, but I'd worked with a former teacher of mine on an early draft of Juventude, and he had said something about the father's character where he said, what's the father's like? The father seems like sort of a manly guy, you know, macho guy. Like, he has no women or like, what is his love life like? Like, is there a girl, an old girlfriend who drops by once in a while? Does he sometimes, I don't know, what is his, it seems noticeably absent. You have to somehow, so I did a little bit of sketching in. It was very minimal, of just like, gave the father, you know, one night he's going to meet friends to go sort of out on the town. And just that was sort of enough to like show that he had some kind, you know. And then the daughter hears that somebody, he brought somebody home with him at, you know, night, some date or something, just to give, and it really helped to make him more of a real round character, where it's like, okay, the guy gets laid once in a while, you know. I'd completely forgotten about that, but yeah, it can become really strangely noticeably absent if you don't recognize things like that, and you know, and that can, and when you're writing fiction.
Well, especially with literature, I mean, we could argue it improves probably all fiction, but you know, right, the daughter is the focus of the novel, and if the mm-hmm. dad has no sex life or even any sex, even in his imagination, that's kind of the wish fulfillment of the daughter, of the pure dad who, you know, like, okay, yeah. Like, once the mother's out of the picture, well, then there is no more reason for sex. I am the perfect daughter. Nothing more could sex accomplish in his life. His, you know, like, it is, and it's...
Yeah. It could potentially start to take on a meat. That would, if you were consciously doing that, or if it became more of a conscientious thing about, like, yeah, dad just, yeah, hasn't had sex since mom left 15 years before. Like, well, that would certainly start to paint a version of that character that would be a particular version, like very particular. So if you don't want that yeah. as to be your, you know, the impression that you're making, like, ooh, you might have to, like, you know, you need to do some shading in there. And
but
shaping,
it also helped even if build only, some conflict yeah. between the daughter and the father. Like, not a lot, not based on that, but some, you know?
Right, but there, you know, a little bit, as any, you know, any adolescent kid who's, you know, dealing with a parent who's occasionally dating or, you know, whatever does, right. It nicely complicates other, you know, tensions, and you know, rather than it just being like, yeah, dad's this hard, you know, this puritanical figure, which is not realistic, you know, and different from a kid being too young to notice mm-hmm. the parents having any kind of sexual, you know, different, like, well, she's old enough to notice things, like, so that doesn't work either. It's not like dad isn't painted as, you know, having any, going on dates because she doesn't, you know, she's completely unaware. So, I mean, I think that's something
that never has sex. He just goes into town once a month at this very regular time, and he's back in the morning. But you know,
he's back in the morning, right? Yeah, clothes are askew, and he's, you know, yeah, got lipstick marks on his neck.
He smells like perfume, so, but that's a coincidence. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something, these are things to keep in mind. Now, you had pointed out when we were chatting about this earlier that she kind of prefaces this or sets this essay of hers up to be like, she's going to help you talk about how to write sex scenes. But then what she then writes doesn't do that. It's more about why, which is fine, but that's not how this is broached when she frames it. So,
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a slight sense of, okay, there are so many options, guys, which is not exactly like, okay, here's how you write a sex scene.
How you overcome the difficulties of actually writing a sex scene, yeah.
It's a little bit like Bob Ross, oh, you know, I'm making a happy tree. You could put the tree wherever you wanted. It's your world. but we're not actually watching her construct a sex scene. Like, it almost kind of happens. People have sex scenes. The two main characters have sex vertically. Like, okay, that was the major detail she gave about that sex scene. And it's not exactly like I want to read that scene necessarily to be titillated by it, but it's like, okay, they're vertical. Like, that doesn't seem that nutty to me. What about that was instructive in terms of what you got out of it as a writer? And so, it's more about the why than the how. And it just seems like the sort of genre equivalent to the Paris Review piece. And they actually make a lot of the same points in different ways.
Mm-hmm. But they do. They definitely echo each other. And the one about the Paris Review is just, you know, it's just given in a more, you know, literary voice. Whereas, yeah, she's explicitly talking about addressing writers of more commercial fiction, but it certainly, you know, can cross over and be applied to just how challenging it can be in writing fiction of any kind that isn't explicitly erotica or romance. You know, okay, how do you tackle this? But she doesn't really, again, it's not a step-by-step or an analysis, like a longer scene of her work where she breaks down how did she, you know, I would think that might be more useful to people if, I don't know, maybe she'd write a part two is called for this.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I'm curious as to what quibbles you have with her about
this. Well, partly the quibbles, a lot of it has to do with the breeziness of her style. You know, like, oh, it requires so much talent, but you should just go ahead and try it, like, whatever. And I'm like, well, that's kind of contradictory. And it's not that it couldn't be paradoxical with some explanation, but without the explanation, it's like, that's just cognitive dissonance. Like, what just happened? So sometimes she makes, I think, brilliant points, but she doesn't necessarily follow up on them. Like, sex is such an intensely personal act. And this is something that the Paris Review piece was hinting at, I think. But is it crass, is it meretricious to write honestly about the mess and complexity of the individual libido? So if we were to figure out what makes you tick, what turns you on, Vanessa, or what turns me on, like if we were to just get at the, I don't know, let's come up with like four sexual triggers, like just what gets us going. If we all had to share notes on that, one, we would probably be horrified that people knew our secret. And then we would look at everyone else's secret going, what the fuck is wrong with you? My perversions are cool. What are you doing? Like, just because I think that's the problem with trying to write sex scenes that may be really particularly exciting to the writer is, like, that may not be someone else's thing, which is why I think in literature we try to focus on the personalities of the people and not necessarily on the physical, even though, like, the physical's part of it.
Yeah, and also, like, why I feel like I did quite a bit of, like, cutting away to a ceiling fan or cutting away, like, describing the how warm the air was in the room, or, you know, these other things that could be evocative of, you know, and do, which you always do, you know, that's what you do in using imagery and certainly in literary fiction. But I think even when approaching sexual scenes, you tend to lean on those even more because they can kind of won't be possibly like misinterpreted or miss the mark. Like exactly what you're saying about, you know, readers having a different, bringing a different, each person is going to bring their own particular taste or experience with this to the table. So maybe that's a way we kind of sidestep those issues or try to. I would say that's my trick. One of my tricks.
Also, a lot of sex isn't that great, which is to say.
Yeah. I mean, there's.
You know, like, or it, like, it's fine, but it's not like, not all sex makes for a great story.
I think that's what you're saying, because I could just say, well, you know, speak
what
for
was
yourself.
what was it? That Seinfeld episode, but, you know, Seinfeld was so smart about the way it dealt with sex, but George said, and then she said yada, yada, yada. And he goes, did yada, yada mean sex? And Elaine goes, yeah, yada yada can totally mean sex. And then he goes, how could that be sex? And she goes, look, I went out with this guy. We went to the nice restaurant. We had the Losbert bisque. And then we went back to his place and yada, yada, yada. I never heard from him again. And George says, but you yada, 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 the best part out. And Elaine goes, no, that's I mentioned right. The bisque.
That's right. Classic, example from American comedy.
And so, she was semantically like very precise about so many things and the sex, like, because we knew where she was evaluating it, it's a lot better than if we actually had the details. Like, okay, how big was the guy? How drunk were you? Like, how nice were the sheets or whatever? Mm-hmm.
So how about, for you know, having read these essays, you then went ahead and sent me a story of yours to read about a character named Mr. Fun. And so I just wondered what was the, I wanted to ask you, has that been published or is this something you've had, you know, that you've been working on for a number of years? And when you were writing that story, what was the intention for that character? Because it is not the version of less is more. It is more of
more
the
is more.
Yeah. More is more, you know, approach.
Or more is too much, but you don't have a choice. This is what you get. Well, that was written for an anthology called Condoms and Hot Tubs Don't Mix by Beating Windward Press.
Uh-huh.
Proceeds from that went to Planned Parenthood, which pleased me no end. And it kind of let me feel freer to write such a horrible character because that's not something that came purely out of my imagination. So another Saturday Night with Mr. Fun, it's sort of this first person confessional by this swaggering dude who thinks he's the
jerk
hottest bachelor in Orlando. And even though he's telling the story and you can see the way he views himself, like you could just see he's horrible in so many ways. And you could just tell that he's the creepy guy at the bar who is on the prowl and looking for easy prey. And he has very specific things he's looking for. But if it's getting the exact right thing or going home with somebody rather than going home alone, like he will just go home with somebody. And all of this was set up actually by...
He's definitely a shallow character. I mean, and then his nickname for himself, which he announces up front being Mr. Fun. I was curious as to what your intentions were with this character. And was this, you said this was someone you had been wanting to write about, or was this sparked by the commission to write for this anthology or that this figure came about?
Well, I didn't invent this character. This was maybe the most obscure work of fan fiction in the history of fan fiction, or certainly of literature. So Joshua Martin and Dan Lauer used to curate a film series called Uncomfortable Brunch. So on Sunday, late mornings, early afternoons, I haven't actually attended this. They will have food and then people will watch disgusting and horrible films usually. So just imagine, all right, let's do brunch, but watch Pink Flamingos, that kind of a vibe. And they had a podcast for a while. And on this one podcast, they just did this thought experiment. Dan Lauer was taking walks in his neighborhood and he had a neighbor who had a vanity plate called Mr. Fun on the kind of car I gave Mr. Fun. And then the two of them riffed on what they imagine this man's life is like. And they were just creating the most horrible specimen imaginable and being really cruel. And they kind of knew, like, okay, we're kind of crossing some boundaries here. And it's like, they weren't using his real name. They didn't know his real name. They're just imagining this horrible person. Like, who would have a vanity plate called Mr. Fun?
Okay. The what if question.
Yeah. And so they did this thought experiment. What would a Saturday night be like for Mr. Fun? So almost everything that happens in my story originates in their mind portrait of this serial, I think Joshua Martin's term was gray rape, a man who just consistently has sex with women who are drunk to the point where their consent, even if given, is questionable.
Mm.
And that was a strong point in my story that I wasn't willing to cross. Like, no, the consent is absolutely coherent in my story because I couldn't write about this character. But yeah, it is an unreliable narrator in which he is the hero in his own story, not realizing how horrible his view of the world is.
I had wondered if you had ever at any point thought of trying to write it or approaching it in third person versus first person, and just wondered about that.
It only works for me in first person. It's such a satanic voice. And the opening lines, that's a doozy of an opening line. And I didn't write that. That was given to me by a woman. So I'm like, hey, can I use that? And they were like, I guess. But it's a very specific and crass observation about women's genitalia. And he's actually very generous in a way that's probably even going to weird people out who it's a positive thing that he's doing, even though he just has to be so gross in the way that he is imagining it. Anyway, so when I had that, though, and I had permission from the person who said that to me, and it's based on a real life observation, you know what? I think I can make the story work. I think I have enough bits where I can imagine the way this whole story would work out. So it is a satire. And it's, you know, like a horrible first-person character.
I wondered, now we're getting more into, yeah.
Well, right. There are so many bizarre things. Like, there's the karaoke DJ with one arm, and it's like, no, I didn't make that up. Like, that that was a thing at Colonial Lanes. So, and in some ways, it's also a story of disappearing Orlando, because some of the landmarks that I write about aren't there anymore.
Well, I wondered if it was at all, or you were inspired by or influenced by or parodying, you know, like Letters to Penthouse kind of from back in the, like, because it had this sort of, it is for the reader without, you know, I encourage you to go find it in the anthology, which is called again, what's the name of the anthology?
Hot Tubs and Condoms Don't Mix.
Okay. So we encourage people to go, you know, look it up in there. But if that was in any way, because it is not holding back. It is very explicit in its rendering of the encounter between the man and Mr. Fun and his, you know, participant who joins him.
His enamorata of the evening.
Yeah. So were you pulling from anything in the past, like thinking about the voice of this character or?
Well, it's the first time I had actually written a sex scene in a long time, even though I've written, I'm pretty sure, more than my fair share. So in the 90s, when online porn just started to be a thing, but you really couldn't have streaming video, some idiot thought that porn in print, or, you know, like text porn, would be a worthwhile thing. And so I wrote some porn and I rationalized it by thinking, oh, well, you know, Anais Nin wrote porn or erotica and, you know, like that's considered classic. So, you know, like this is, you know, like I'm pretty interested in sex and I love writing. And so, yeah, if I could get paid to write about sex, like, great. And I wasn't paid a lot, but turns out, yeah, I can't write porn reliably because it requires a lack of interest in humanity.
Which requires being gratuitous. I mean, it sort of requires that which we veer away from in writing.
Or it requires some sort of like unhealthy compulsion. Because if I, you know, partly it's like, okay, I need each story to be different. And the standards were really low. It's not like there were, you know, like writing editors overseeing what was happening. You know, and I've looked online. Apparently, I don't think these, like I got paid. I don't think they ever ended up online anywhere. So they're just on my hard drive and they're, you know, initially they're vaguely interesting and they're literary without being too showy. And at the end, I'm totally trying to write those penthouse forum letters. I never thought that when I went to work for a septic company that I would be having a threesome, but here's how it happened. Like, I just start with a completely ridiculously stupid premise and try and, you know, write my way in and out of it. And so I think I was supposed to write a dozen stories and it's like, they didn't take much time to write. And like for like four or five of them, I'm like, hey, this is pretty cool. Like getting paid to write, not a lot, but something. And then by like seven, I'm like, I I don't think I have any more in me. This is, this is kind of while I was writing my first novel, which has not been published. I think it's good, but that one has a sexual focus. And so there, the sex, I think it's explicit almost always, but it's in a very human context. And yeah, also I was like, I was logic also, yeah, in my 20s when I started. And like when I finished a couple of Christmases ago, yeah, like let's just say my hunger for writing sex scenes just wasn't that.
But it was
in
your sexual,
yeah, in my 20s, it's like, yeah, more sex. And it's like, so that, you know, in my novel, in the novel that is published, Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame, there's a very important sexual encounter that I don't show. Like I show the postcoital luxuriating, but I don't show the sexy part. And something that, you know, our New York Times bestseller, J.T. Ellison, says is, you know, she says it's about being naked. And, you know, my characters, I have a scene in which Guy Psycho is naked. And he's naked with the person he eventually has sex with, but the nakedness isn't about sex. It is about having to show humility in a sacred place. And there's no sex I could write that could top that gesture. And like, there was just, and it's not like, oh, and let me, like, partly, okay, he's a lounge singer. Who's famous. It's not like, oh, I wonder if he'll ever have sex. Like, that's not, it's kind of like James Bond. You know, you find out, ooh, there's a soothsayer, and her powers come from her virginity. And I'm like, I wonder where the plot's gonna go. So Guy Psycho's flirting is like more interesting than, okay, like more, his attitudes towards sex is kind of more interesting than the having of sex or the opportunity, because for him, it's just part of the way of life, whether he even wants the attention or not. So I feel like, you know, I've spent so much of my life writing sex scenes, you know, like one just for filthy lucre, like, okay, you'll give me money, I'll write the filth. And even lowering my standards as much as possible, I couldn't keep up the writing of the porn. And like, I was just recycling characters. Like, here's a lesbian couple, and like, here's every orifice and toy I can. And like, kind of like with an A.S. Nin, like the reports kept, you know, when I would show the work, they would be like, okay, I think the person buying her erotica was kept saying less poetry. And in this case, it's like, yeah, no, less psychology. And it's like, less characters, just like, all right. Which reminds me of the great David Tell, and he said, I look like a porn director, but I don't think I could be a porn director because I just don't think there's much to the work. He's like, and suck it. Like, okay, so what, which maybe not entirely fair. So when I had this opportunity, because I knew I wanted to redeem Mr. Fun, or at least I wanted that challenge. Mm-hmm. Like, what if I put the most positive spin on Mr. Fun that I can? And that in his own way, he's trying to be good to women. In his own way, he is trying to elevate karaoke. In his own way, he is trying to make the workplace more noble, even though he's deranged. Even though, like, if I had to work with him, I would want my desk as far the fuck away from him as possible. You know, like, that was kind of my challenge. And so I knew that I wanted it to be funny. And so it's, you know, I needed the voice to write it in third person. Like, oh no, like.
Right. Well, I almost wondered, like, it's just funny because when I got to the end, I thought of the letter, you know, I was like, what does this make me think of? And it's, oh yeah, like letters to Penthouse. Not that I've encountered that many of, you know, those in my, but you know, and occasionally have seen some magazines and familiarized myself with her content. And
you being, yeah, a person of the world, yeah,
a person of the world, one must be, you know, familiar, at least, you know, in passing on these things. Yeah, almost wondered, like, wow, would this be even funnier if it was like in a more overt stylized, like if this actually was in letter format. Maybe it's a little too long for that. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But it's funny that you, and I'm glad you relayed that about your background, which I think at some point I feel like, oh yes, I knew this about John, that you've mentioned this before about this. Hey, you know, 25 years ago, I got paid to write, one of my first gigs was getting paid to write this smutty stuff. And now it's like, oh, this is all making a little bit more sense as to where, you know, some of this character has come from and the, you know, the language and everything. So I'm really glad you shared that.
Well, it's one of those stories. It's not for everybody. And it really forces you to make a choice. Are you in or are you out, like right away?
Yeah. And I wonder, like, to me, I would think that character would be really hard to keep up. Like, if you were inspired to write a novel in this, with this person, it's like, oh, I don't know that would, yikes. Like, following Mr. Fun for any longer, you know, I don't know, you know.
Well, I have given that some thought, and it's the kind of thing where, all right, if this anthology, you know, hadn't been coming out, and if the one of the missions of the book wasn't to support women, then, you know, I think it would have been a silly idea, but like so many pieces fell into place, including the opening zinger. That I'm like, no, like I can do all of this. I can actually see all of this working. I don't think it's the kind of story, like, I'm a little bit too old, I think, to be writing things that are just outrageous just because I want to be wicked and I want to see people freak out.
The impulse of the 20-year-old under college undergrad boy in our classrooms who just, you know, the workshop stories that you get that are,
I'm going to write some edgy shit. Yeah.
I'm going to write some edgy, you know, the shock value story, which I don't get too many of those anymore. I don't know where I kind of feel like I should be worried about that. Like what's happened to the, maybe you, I don't know, maybe where you teach you're still getting them regularly.
I think millennials are less asshole-ish. That's my guess. Millennials and people younger than them, I think, you know, because, you know, I think we're past anyone looking up to Norman Mailer and going, I want to be just like that, you know. Even people who may go, Philip Roth was pretty great, but maybe I don't need to hate women as much, or
I don't think they know who those authors are anymore. I don't think those people are read.
So I think they have better role models. That's my guess. Or maybe it's my desperate hope. But yeah, I think there's less of that going around. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, when I've surveyed my classes and they tell me what, first of all, they list off a lot of TV shows and then they list books like, you know, Twilight and Harry Potter and things like that. So I don't know that the issue is that they are actually coming from a place of more depth. but then again, my creative writing students tend to skew more female than male. You know, I don't know. I feel like it'll be interesting. I actually had a class with no males in it last spring when I taught. It was 17, you know, undergrad girls. But in any case, that's sort of neither here nor there. But I don't know. Just in terms of that story, it could, you know.
Well, you know, I think that story. Actually maybe this conversation is completely relevant. J.T. Ellison did point out that there is this divide in genders and the way that we, you know, include sex and storytelling because there is that double standard. And, you know, like I could totally have that double standard with Guy Psycho, which is why I try and shy away from it. In some ways, that is what the ziggurat of shame is about. But I try and make sure that Guy Psycho shares it because, you know, simply replicating the patriarchy is not interesting, not fun, not...
I don't know that I've felt that... I've been inhibited as a female writer in terms of, like, you know, how I'm presenting sexual scenes or not. That is interesting. That does leave me with something to ponder, her essay raising that point. I don't know that that's something I have run into, but maybe I just haven't written enough of those types of scenes or had to, I'm not sure. It does make me think of the one story, Ask Jesus, which is a little bawdy in its depiction of the sexual dynamic between the two protagonists. And that was a story where I never really came out and named the narrator as male or female. So some people have read that story as a lesbian story, which I don't really care if they I didn't write it with any kind of intention. So the narrator, you don't know what the gender is. And then it makes me wonder, well, are people giving me a certain license as a female author by how they think, you know, by their read of whether that narrator is male or female, you know.
It's probably a Rorschach test, right? Like, okay, like,
yeah,
it reveals more about you as the reader, what gender you have assumed the narrator is.
Yeah. And I remember I did make that choice when I realized I had just written the story. And in my mind, it was a male narrator talking about his wife or what have you. But because when I realized that there were no glaringly obvious markers, signals as to this person, I was like, well, I'm just going to leave it. I think that's kind of fun, you know, let that and see what the response is. And sure enough, people have brought their own questions or, you know, projections to that. And that's fine. That's the fun of fiction. But then you wonder, like, well, then does that also then grant the writer more liberty or more, you know, than they would otherwise have gotten if it would, I don't know, you know, something to think about.
Well, it's a little bit like that, Prodigy song. They've got a video for Smack My Bitch Up, which shows this crazy bacchanal, like drug-induced, sex-induced, like just crazy sped up night. But the camera is from the point of view of the actual person experiencing it. So like the camera is where the head would be. And then at the end, like this person has just had a horrible, miserable, like Hunter S. Thompson-esque series of horrible misadventures. And then the camera, you know, it like there's the mirror and it's like, oh, this was a woman we were watching behave this poorly and having sex with a woman and snorting coke and throwing up and doing this and doing that. And, you know, it's even more interesting in a story like yours, because I remember my reaction to that indeterminate narrator. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to make a decision about what gender that is. And instead I'm just going to keep watching and reading. But I remember being very attuned to the choices I make as a reader in terms of like how I build a story with the writer.
With the writer, right. It's kind of fun to think about. Yeah. And, you know, when the writer gives you a little bit more or leaves a bit more room on the canvas for the reader to, you know, join them and have their own imaginative experience, you know, that interplay between, that's a really fun thing to think about or consider. And writing, approaching sex definitely forces you or should force you, sex on the page, to really think about those things too.
Yeah. I think that may be one of the greatest frontiers left for, you know, writing about sexuality.
One of the only frontiers left, if you could argue. I don't know. Are there any frontiers left? Not sure.
Well, when I think of Another Saturday Night with Mr. Fun, there's nothing about it that's new. Like, okay, maybe we haven't seen that particular monstrous character. You know, he is a little bit, like, just imagine if, you know, the main character of A Confederacy of Dunces had more swagger and, you know, thought he had sex appeal, and you might get Mr. Fun. Like, I don't know that character resembles quite any other character I've seen a lot of, but, you know, the actual story itself, apart from the narration, in terms of a satire, I was going pretty, like, I was treating it straight. Like, I wasn't going, oh my God, like, her butt went in the air and they got caught in the ceiling fan. Like, it wasn't a slapstick sex scene.
It's not over the top in that. It's not extreme like that, right? It's the style of it. It's I was pleased to see Whiskey Lou's in there. I don't know that Whiskey Lou's has been, that's an Orlando bar, a long time. I don't know how long Whiskey Lou's has been there. I don't know, I would say decades, but so there's a fresh detail.
I did research all the places I wrote about. I had to go visit. So I kind of did this the way that people do the Bloomsday tour and they walk everywhere Leopold Bloom walked. Yeah, I kind of had to follow in the footsteps of the Mr. Fun as imagined by the Uncomfortable Brunch duo there.
And yet you did not bring it to Disney. It was not.
Well, no, I felt constrained by the story they were telling about this imaginary person. Yeah, not everything has a Disney angle. So I don't know that we've actually said anything helpful to readers who are or writers.
We have carried on much as
JT Ellison.
JT, we have perhaps continued the murky conversation of not actually giving you any, or we could just call it part one of a conversation. Perhaps we can revisit this topic with, I don't know, more analysis or.
I think you and I would have to read actual sexual scenes and then kind of explicate them.
Instead, I'd rather just point people to fiction by writers such as Mary Gateskill and Marguerite Duras. And you can throw yours in there as well if you like, John. Who are your recommendations?
You know, I think Aeneas Nin, and you know, mm-hmm. for her, the psychological titillation is always a lot greater than the sexy bits. The sexy parts. Yeah,
somehow I missed her as a teenager. I don't think she, I don't know how, but in my, well, you know, I know how, because we didn't have the internet to do this. I didn't have the internet in 1995 to do this research. Somehow I stumbled upon, you know, what were supposedly kind of classic works of erotic literature. And I don't quite know how I even found the books that I did, really. I mean, they certainly weren't in the Scholastic catalog for high school books or something. I don't know. It's not like there is a display of these at Walden Books, rest in peace. So I can't, you know, my memory is murkier about how sadly she remains a gaping hole.
Don't say that.
Gaping hole in the canon, John, in the canon.
Well, you know, also you missed Henry and June, the film, which tells the story of the affair between Aeneas Nin and Henry Miller. So she was friends with Henry Miller. And mm-hmm. one of the things that happened with my awareness of her is I ended up, finding Aeneas Nin through Henry Miller. And so Henry Miller writes explicitly about sex and phantasmagorically about sex. And it's kind of interesting that Aeneas Nin also wrote about sex in ways that could be similar, but she's less crass and actually seems to have more to say and says it in a more efficient way than Henry Miller.
Well, good to know. And I'll tell you what, if we end up doing a part two in, you know, of this conversation, if you feel free to assign me some, and then there, voila, I will, my gaping canonical literary hole will be filled. It will be satisfied, hopefully.
I think we have to give each other homework. So I also will need to fill some holes of mine with recommendations from you so that it is closer to being a mutual hole filling.
Sounds good.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Vanessa Blakeslee, Alexander Pate, and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster, and The Sozzled Scribbler as transcribed by Dimitri Cockme. All right, gang, please, 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 if you like this show, leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen. Also, think about getting my wonderful novel, Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame. It's good. All right, until next time, gang, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life, is a supernova, an interstellar jamboree of colors and lights, like the twirling dresses of a troupe of champion folk dancers, like being imprisoned inside Ace Frehley's amp, throbbing like the veins in Jehovah's hard-on. You can look, but you can't touch, and also you can't look, because if you do, you will turn to stone, and your guts will turn to marble.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think... Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.